Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati,
and we are here with some totally true stories.
Yeah, some totally killer stories.
Some murderously good stories.
That's it.
That's all I got. We are back for our episode on true crime. An episode designed to break the algorithms of the internet and get us all the listeners and followers we could ever possibly want. But before we do, we did want to squeak in a couple of announcements because, as always, we will be taking August off. August will still be kind of a busy month for us. We're going to be doing a couple things in the background to, announce in September. So make sure you're subscribed and stay tuned
Exciting
and all that
things.
Good stuff.
Things you're going to like.
We hope so. And speaking of things that will keep you in the know about Faculty of Horror, of course, our newsletter launched last month. We have a really good start with that, and a lot of people are subscribing and seem to like it. So if you aren't subscribed, that episode will be in the show link. Of course, Salem Horror is coming up October 5th. We will be there for a live show on Under the Skin.
Yep.
And I will be giving a lecture that same day on October 5th about social media in horror films. So that will be a lot of my August is working on that lecture. And then finally, merchandise. Our class of 2019 merchandise will be on sale till the end of August. At the end of August, it's going to be gone. Gone forever. Gone for good. It's not coming back. So if you want it, if you like t-shirts, if you like a tote bag, make sure you get on it.
You forgot the most important announcement. Alex got bangs.
Oh, shit. I did. You know. It was the scariest thing because I got bangs the height of summer.
We had an event in Toronto the other night. It was the Black Museum's Nightmare Board Game Night, and I was live streaming it on the RuMorg Instagram, and somebody was like, "Is that Alex? She got bangs. I like her bangs." Did you see that?
I didn't.
You're famous.
Oh, geez. Well, my face is. Apparently, I look a lot younger with them.
Anyway, those bangs are not a crime, but we're going to talk about crime. We're going to talk about movies that deal with crime, but we saw it fit to perhaps have a little mini discussion before we jump into these films about what it is we're going to be talking about and what it is we aren't going to be talking about. Because God knows, true crime and podcasts go together like piss and shit.
Like cereal and milk.
Oh, that's better. That's way better than my analogy.
But true crime. So when people ask me or ask us about podcasting, all of that kind of stuff, I say, well, I am so fortunate because my co-host and I got into podcasting at a time that I like to call PS or pre-serial. And I think that has a lot to do with true crime. I think true crime has come in waves. I think that true crime has always kind of been around. There are some misconceptions about true crime having these really big moments. And yes, it totally has. But true crime has been around since records were kept, since poems were written, since songs were sung, from penny dreadfuls to true detective magazines to 48 Hours. All kinds of places are finding narratives and finding stories that are scintillating and scandalous and shocking and upsetting, and they want to tell them. And there's always an audience, there's always an appetite for them, and there always has been. But I think there are a few key moments that we need to recognize. The first is Truman Capote's nonfiction book, In Cold Blood, and that was about two killers on death row about to be put to death, and the whole kind of mystery around what happened and the crime and how the crime kind of came to be. And it is an incredibly famous book. It is an incredibly well-respected book. It's been turned into a movie and a TV miniseries a couple times. And that was a really important moment for true crime to kind of enter a really mainstream, high-minded, popular culture atmosphere. But then in 2014, there was the breakout from the NPR podcast This American Life called Serial, which focused on a true crime that occurred in 1999, and that broke the internet. It broke the internet almost as much as Kim Kardashian's butt.
It broke the podcasting world. That's for damn sure.
It broke podcasting from this niche thing that a couple of nerds were doing. Not a couple of nerds, lots of nerds. But nerds were doing into something that, like, parents were like, I should do that. My friends were all of a sudden like, I need to learn how to download podcasts. For me, that was a real watershed moment in podcasting. It became really popular and really opened up the field to it.
Oh, yeah. And I'd say it was the first one that I got hooked on.
Yeah.
And at that time, I had already been podcasting for the years, but I was starting to take the long way home.
And that was a big part of it. And then, of course, you have things like Netflix making a murderer, more and more books coming out, more podcasts coming out, and, you know, more and more crimes being revisited with this lens of kind of a gumption to solve things, to unearth things, to understand something about the world. And true crime is that. It is an analysis of a crime that has happened.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think true crime has a very close relationship with horror, but it's not exactly horror. So one of the reasons I wanted to have this discussion straight off the bat, straight out the gate, is because I consider it a pretty touchy and sensitive subject when it comes to how to deal with true crime and how to approach true crime. And a couple of years ago, when Ted Bundy captured everyone's attention with two Netflix releases, there were two releases that came out around the same time. There was the documentary, Conversations with a Killer, and then there was that extremely wicked, shockingly evil and vile movie, which is both its title and its synopsis, starring Zac Efron. Both of those were made by the same guy, by the way, which is just really weird to me. Anyway, those releases were so popular that I started getting a lot of mail and social media comments to Rue Morgue being like, you should cover this, you should cover this. It's horror, is it not? And I had to really confront that question, and I did so in my editorial of the March-April issue, but basically to summarize it here is that one is true and the other is fiction, and that's the most surface-level thing to that, but going deeper. And I want to say right at the onset that I'm not shaming anyone for loving true crime. I love true crime. It's fine. I'm not saying that it's weird or deviant or uncool to like true crime. I can just, in my mind's eye, see our email inbox, like, filling up with criticism about that. I am in no position to judge anyone's taste of entertainment, okay? I like a Serbian film. It's fine. I listen to Serial just like everyone else, and just like everyone else, I lost interest after season two. I'm not attacking you. What I'm about to say is my own assessment of the difference between horror and true crime and where I stand between them. Now, I would argue that both horror movies and true crime tick a lot of the same boxes. They're definitely related because they allow you to approach sensationalistic tales of violence from a safe distance. And when we say distance, that can mean a number of things. For me, that safe distance is in the fiction. That is the distance that not only allows me to, sleep at night, so to speak, but also that allows me to step back and analyze horror the way I like to analyze horror. I can analyze fiction as a reflection of society. That's my bag. That's my shtick. That's what I'm on this podcast to do. That's what makes me tick. And I can only do that with fiction. I can't do that with true crime. With true crime, I mean, we can talk about the cultural explosion, which I'm sure we're going to get into. I definitely do want to talk about that, and I think it's fascinating and interesting. However, that same distance does not exist. Insofar as I can watch a horror movie and feel pathos for the victims in the film, I have a completely different kind of pathos when those victims are real, when those families are real, when those communities are real. And again, I'm not saying that true crime is fucked up or that people who watch it are fucked up people. It's just different. It's just fundamentally different. And it rubs me a different way. Still a delicious way. Like I said, I still indulge in it. But I want to be really clear that the way we're going to talk about these movies, we're not going to make fun. This isn't a comedy podcast about true crime. I'm not entirely clear how tasteful that is. It's evidently very, very popular, but it's not my bag. I don't think it's Alex's bag. We're going to talk about these films as films, and we're going to talk about this subject as a subject.
So as Andrew was mentioning, there's a lot of different facets to being interested in true crime, what makes one gravitate towards true crime, and they're all valid. They're all interesting. As long as you're not a serial killer approaching them for research, I think it's all pretty cool. You know, you do you. But as anything, you know, as we experience as horror fans, when you like something that is dark, twisted, weird, any combination of those things, there are, of course, a lot of articles, a lot of opinion pieces about why do you like that? Why do people out there like horror? Why do people out there like true crime? Mm-hmm. And much like horror films, which have, you know, pretty generous box office receipts almost all of the time, true crime has, you know, branched out into a multitude of things. Netflix series, incredibly successful podcasts, books, TV, movies, all of those things. And there's a lot of anxiousness. There is a lot of concern mm-hmm. about why people might like that. So I did some reading. I did some digging around. And I kind of wound back up at the place where I always thought I did with true crime. So there are some theories that, you know, it's a way for people to feel like they are contributing, that they are going to solve the crime, that they might have a piece of evidence that will allow them to, you know, unlock something that was not there before. There are several articles that point to the kind of high number of women who really respond to true crime.
Yeah. White women especially.
Yeah, white women especially, and that there is a notion that because women experience violence and it's not often talked about, true crime is a way to learn how to navigate, to learn how to survive. If you hear what a survivor did, maybe in the back part of your reptilian brain, you'll know, like, oh, I do that when I'm attacked. Or mm-hmm. if, you know, someone is brutally killed, you know, shit, I shouldn't do that. So to many outsiders, to people who are maybe not in situations where crime and violence exist for them on an everyday level, it can seem really random and it can seem really chaotic. And I think true crime does a service in creating a narrative around it. Mm. It picks up a beginning, a middle, and maybe an ending, maybe not an ending. So I think it gives us a way to interpret crime in a way, if, you know, our lives are touched by it or not touched by it. There is a narrative that we can scope around it to say, this is how I can experience it. This is how I can deal with this.
Yeah.
You know, like the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yeah.
That's really scary and really disturbing. And there are so many theories out there. Like if you go on Reddit and search JonBenet Ramsey, holy shit.
Oh, nice.
But if you watch the 2020 special on it, mm-hmm. there is a formula there. There is a seemingly almost comforting formula that will guide you through this story and that will leave you with some kind of conclusion, even if it's not like, well, X killed her. Mm-hmm. She is over here. Or actually, she is Katy Perry.
Whoa. No, you're absolutely right. And sociology has a whole branch of criminology, looking at what different impacts society can have on the criminal mind, if the criminal mind exists or if it's just a societal precondition. Sociology definitely tends to posit that the environment has to do with criminology, that, you know, people in low income situations, people who are alienated from other people tend to commit crime. And this goes all the way back to Emil Durkheim, who I know I've talked about on this podcast before. He was a structural functionalist, which is to say that all social things have a purpose in society or else they wouldn't exist. So you would think that a society without crime would be the perfect utopia, but he argues that even crime has its functions in that, A, it maintains boundaries. So insofar as we can agree that killing sprees are bad, okay, it brings us together in solidarity. Now, we might not be able to agree on everything, but one thing that most people agree on is that killing sprees are bad. Even Trump supporters can agree on that with the rest of us, right? And the other thing is adaptation and change. Crime can have a really positive function in eliciting change when the laws are no longer serving society. And civil disobedience is a really powerful and important thing sometimes. You know, the suffragettes are a great example of that. Black Lives Matter. Sometimes crime has to fuck shit up, and we need that to exist as crime and be understood as crime for it to have that kind of impact. So I absolutely agree with you that true crime obviously has its function, and I think it's perfectly normal for us to be curious about it. I think it's perfectly normal for us to seek a narrative that approaches these things with a beginning and a middle and an end, even if they're open-ended or even if they point to bad police investigation or questionable institutional practices. I think that's part of the boom that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. I think a big part of it is, you know, when you look back at a show like Cops, right. Remember Cops?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you are a camera affixed to a dashboard. You know nothing about what's going on, only that you are going to take someone, you're going to throw them to the ground and cuff them, and justice is served another day. It's very one-sided, it's very limited, it's very lowbrow, I dare say. It's kind of junk culture. But then, when we're talking about making a murderer, and indeed talking about serial, we've got the host giving very candid observations about the case. Like, you really get the sense that she's speaking from her heart. She's speaking to the accused directly, and we're hearing those conversations. So it's not only very intimate, like you were saying, it puts us in the role of armchair detective. You almost feel involved in this. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we're going to talk about in one of the films we're going to talk about shortly. But I think, in great measure, the recent true crime boom, if you want to call it as much, isn't so much a boom. It's more of a repackaging of what it is we've already loved. And it's a repackaging in a way that's, you're willing to admit that you love it. Mm-hmm. I found a really cool article on, it was a really cool series actually on Vulture, where they took a whole week to explore this boom. Did you find that in your research?
I didn't, but they're a great site.
I have a link that I'm going to put in the show notes, because there's one article by Alice Bolin. She's written a lot on true crime, and she points out that while true crime appears to be having a huge boom, it's been around for a long time, since the dawn of modern journalism, blah, 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 blah. But the biggest shift is that there's a certain shamelessness that's new, is people are ready to admit that they watch true crime, because true crime isn't being presented the way it was in Cops. It's being presented in these critical, thoughtful, high production value documentaries that aren't like cheesy reenactments. I think that's a big part of the story.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. I mean, there's a prestige quality to it now. When you have major podcast networks getting behind it, when you have elements like Netflix getting behind it, when you have major books coming out, there is a level there where you go, you know, this isn't me reading theories on Reddit, even though some of the theories on Reddit are better written than some books out there. Mm-hmm. This is like, I'm picking up this important hardback book, or I'm going to the first recommendation on Netflix and I'm going to watch this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I think there is a shamelessness to it now where we can all kind of be like, I like wine and true crime. But also they like, NPR is doing this.
Yeah.
NPR has sanctioned my love of true crime.
It's a validation.
It is a complete validation. And, you know, for me, I'm not a murderino. You know, I've listened to the first season of Serial. I watched Making a Murderer. I've dabbled in it here and there. I'm always down for a good story. But for me, my kind of most in-depth look at true crime has been with Jack the Ripper.
Oh, yeah.
Ever since I was a little kid, I was really, really interested in Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
I think it was a mix of my dad being British and telling me about it. My mom watching this movie called Time After Time. It's a fictional movie where H.G. Wells, who's played by Malcolm McDowell, has to go hunt him down in modern day San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I had this kind of weird notion of Jack the Ripper. And then the older I got and the more I was able to read about it, it really fucked with my sense of right and wrong.
Is that right?
Because I was raised with such a strong sense of, like, this is right and this is wrong. And then the more I understood of Jack the Ripper was like, oh, well, then right and wrong doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Explain.
He killed sex workers and he got away with it.
He was caught and got away with it?
No, he got away with it. He was never caught.
Oh, he was. Okay. So where's the shade of gray?
Because in
my
notion of right and wrong, if someone does something wrong, you get caught and you get punished.
Why? Justice wasn't served.
Justice was not served.
Gotcha.
These adults never figured it out.
Yeah.
And there's theory after theory after theory about who Jack the Ripper was.
Okay.
And I don't have a favorite theory. There's no hill I will die on in that conversation. But probably when I was like 9 or 10 and I was really wrapping my head around this, it was like, oh, sometimes people just get away with things.
Yeah.
And that was a rather sobering thought.
No shit.
To a young Alex.
Yeah.
There's a strange morality that goes along with true crime for me.
So, do you want to talk about movies? Because
I
want to talk about movies.
Love to talk about movies. So, we've evened our playing field. I think we have a general understanding of true crime and where Andrea and I are coming from based on true crime and our understanding of it. So, without further ado, we're going to talk about 1986/1990s, depending on who you're listening to. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Otis, plug it in.
Did you really kill your mama?
What?
Did you really kill your mama?
I guess I did.
She must have treated you real bad.
She's a whore.
Susie! Susie!
You used to dance naked?
Sure, all the time around town.
Otis.
Best little naked dancer you ever saw.
You never.
You telling me you never killed anybody before?
I ain't saying that.
It's either you or them. You know what I mean. Don't do that, Otis. She's your sister.
I feel like I know you. Like I've known you for a long time. I feel like I've known you forever and ever.
It's like the blood droppings from a deer you shot. And all they gotta do is follow those droppings, and pretty soon they're gonna find that deer.
I ain't interrupting this, man.
What are you doing?
Well, I'll see it again.
Serial killer Henry has arrived in Chicago to stay with his old friend Otis. Otis's sister Becky has also come to Chicago to escape her abusive ex. While Becky forges a bond with Henry, he continues to kill indiscriminately and soon involves Otis in the murders. Becky decides she needs to go back to care for her daughter and asks Henry if he will join her. Otis rapes Becky, and Henry and Becky kill him and dispose of the body. The film ends with Henry and Becky seemingly starting a new life together, but Henry kills her, dumping her body and driving off on his own.
Dude, that's a stark synopsis for a stark-ass movie. This movie delivers the blows one after the other with this really grimy, unflinching realism. It has a real urban grit to it that's really, I don't know, I felt pretty gross.
And it's a really impressive film in a lot of ways because I absolutely agree about the realism thing. And a lot of reviews, a lot of articles about Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer mention that. But I also find it to be quite a filmic film. Mm. There's an artistry there. It's incredibly low budget. John McNaughton, the director, it's his first feature. There's a lot of stuff about the making of this film and how it was made for no money and there are no extras. So the people in the background were actually like having arguments and doing all their shit and living their life while they were filming. But it has this overarching control and this restraint to it. And I think it's the restraint of this film that actually makes it more chilling and eerie. Mm. And again, it's that same restraint that the film overall has and that Michael Rooker, who plays Henry, mm-hmm. has as well. It's such an incredible performance because it is so restrained. It is subdued. But there is this like gentle charisma that comes through mm-hmm. when he is on screen. There's a magnetism there. I was reading one article today that kind of said, you know, he has a Brandoism in the film, which I actually kind of see. You know, as Becky is, I guess, falling in love with him, you almost understand that.
Well, you can totally get it, because especially in contrast to Otis, who is so crude, so lecherous, even when he's dealing with his sister, and here you've got this perfect stranger, Henry, who's like, no, that's not cool. That's, you know, that makes him seem very appealing. Mm-hmm. It makes him seem very moral. It makes him seem very gentle. And you make all these inferences. And I think that complexity was really important to portraying a serial killer, because this is the mid-80s. So culturally, we had a sense of what a serial killer is, or the beginnings of a sense of what a serial killer is.
And to be clear, a serial killer, you need 3 kills to be considered a serial killer.
I think that's the current legal definition.
That's the current legal definition, and generally they track a serial killer by having a kind of similar MO to each kill.
That's right. Typically, but again, like if we're approaching these films from a point of view of how they reflect society, I think what's really interesting about Henry is there are kind of 80s criminological values imposed upon this film. Like if we consider Psycho, we talked about Psycho in a previous episode, that was 1960. There was a really rudimentary understanding of dissociative mm-hmm. identity disorder. And the movie got some things right, but it also got a lot of things wrong. And so by the time 1986 came about, there were some understandings about what might compel someone to commit mass murder. And some of those are throwbacks from the 60s that you came from a broken home. And then there's some newer stuff, the societal effects of urbanization, poverty, abuse from a maternal figure, stuff like that. But for the most part, even in the 80s, they didn't really know. Serial killers were so erratic, and that was depicted in this film in that montage of the victims early on. There were women, there were men. There was the private sphere, there was the public sphere. There was working people, there was private people. It was indiscriminate. And so I like how that's kind of reflecting some of the confusion that society had around serial killers at the time. And yet there was an understanding that they were charismatic.
Yes.
And able to bend people to their will.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer is based loosely on the real-life serial killer, Henry Lee Lucas, who did work with a guy he used to know, Otis, on some murders. Mm-hmm. That's true. There's a couple other small things that kind of feed into the overall narrative plot, i.e. Henry had relations with Otis's niece, but she was quite underage.
Yeah.
And like in some ways, the real story is actually quite a bit darker and more disturbing. It is based on a true series of events. Of course, Henry Lee Lucas confessed to all of these murders.
And more, like hundreds.
He was just sitting there just confessing. Mm-hmm. And they very quickly, the investigators just knocked a bunch of them off because he didn't have the proper information. You know, all the cross-checking they do, they were like, no, stop it. So part of what I think, if you're a longtime listener to the podcast, what I like to do is I like to look at the title of something. In attempting to kind of take this film apart, I started with the title and, of course, Portrait. Portrait of a Serial Killer. And portrait, as a kind of general definition, is a representation of a person. Mm-hmm. And what this film is it's a brief glimpse into the life or the persona or the viewpoint of a serial killer. And what I think this film tries to do overall is it tries to place a narrative on him. The narrative that I was kind of talking about earlier tries to take this filmic structure, place it on this chaotic character, and the chaotic character ultimately circumvents and subverts the narrative.
Right.
They kind of throw a couple things in there that are, like, the big one for me is the insertion of Becky, who's, you know, a gentle, likable, kind character who has terrible taste in men and gravitates towards Henry. And in the narrative, it's very much a kind of Beauty and the Beast kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, this gentle woman loves this horrible man and maybe she can change him. And the murder she takes part in with Henry is due to Otis assaulting and raping her and fighting back. And Henry defends her. And so she fights back as well and helps him. And maybe it'll all be okay now. Don't worry about the sex workers that he murdered and the man he murdered and all of these people. He could change. Wait, he didn't.
Right.
She was yet another victim.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as soon as her body is left on the side of the road, he leaves the narrative and the narrative ends.
That's right.
And so it's a very fatalistic film in my view. It's a very interesting one because, again, it's trying to show that sometimes these crimes, these people, they are reckless and they are scary and they are impenetrable.
Mm-hmm.
They are not storyable. They are not confined by anything that you or I could talk about.
Right, which is interesting because a lot of the fictional serial killers / monsters, they have a bit of an MO. They have a bit of a code. Freddy's after the Elm Street kids. Jason's after campers at Crystal Lake. As arbitrary as they are, they're not exactly random. So when we're dealing with someone like Henry Lee Lucas, like, you're right, if this were a documentary that documented, you know, his childhood going all the way to his capture, to his specious claims to murdering hundreds of people that they were only able to pin someone, and then he goes to jail, that's a true crime story. But a horror movie? A horror movie is going to have him introduced as a clean-cut, cool guy. It's going to have us agonizing over what he does next. And I feel like there's almost an implication that there might be a code. Because in horror movies, there are codes.
Oh, like, absolutely.
Murderers have codes. Like, even in, if you think of Dexter.
Yeah.
Very, very popular show about a serial killer who imposes a moral code upon himself that kind of makes him the hero in a really weird way. And so you tell yourself that, you know, maybe he can change. You believe in him. You believe in Becky. And you believe that there is some morality to him. But in the end, there's not. And that's scary. That's a horror story. You don't want to see the justice of him going to jail. You want to get the thrill of the randomness of his crimes.
Absolutely. And I think for horror films and films in general, mythology is such an important step.
Because
you can make anything a mythology. From the supernatural to based in real life, you can have it, you can add it to your story. What I think is so interesting about Henry is that he has no mythology. Most specifically, and one of the elements I found so interesting about this film is when he talks about his mother. So it's alluded to that she was a sex worker and she beat him and there was a lot of things happening there and that she kind of roused this murderous instinct in him and that he killed her. But how did he kill her? the story changes several times throughout the narrative. Mm-hmm. So while it's seemingly a quote-unquote small thing, you know, even Becky calls him out on it. Mm-hmm. So you've got Henry making up his own mythology, changing his own narrative. Did he shoot her? Did he stab her? What did he do? Is he going out west to California? But then at another point, Otis asks him, where are you going? And he says, nowhere.
Yeah.
There is, you know, a constant turning where we actually never have a grasp on who he is. We never understand what his next move is going to be.
Yeah, he doesn't fit in our boxes, which is what's really chilling about it. And I think a portrait, you know, as you said, it's like a snapshot. It's a framing. It's a moment beginning to end. And even the poster of this film is him looking in the mirror. That is the portrait. It is not him all prettied up. It's him in a tank top looking like shit.
One of the things I found really interesting in this film, one of the elements that really intrigued me right off the bat, is the use of the camera and the use of television. You know, if true crime, for me anyway, is about imposing a narrative structure on violence in order to make sense of it, Henry ultimately rejects that notion. And the violence and the crime, it's random and without purpose or resolution, and it leaves everyone vulnerable. Again, because there's no mythology, there's no MO, anyone can be a victim. Mm-hmm. Anyone can be next. And Henry kind of takes pains to show that. And in, you know, some moments, it's like you have to pick the people on the outskirts of society. But then they seemingly attack a well-to-do family.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the man driving the car off side of the road. And what is so interesting to me, and it's kind of a red herring a little bit in the film, is when they pick up that video camera, when they, you know, murder the attendant at the TV store. Now, it brought me back a lot to actually the other film we talked about in the Psycho episode, which was Peeping Tom. And I thought it was so interesting because Henry and Otis are obsessed with documenting themselves. There is a couple people when they talk about, you know, the most fucked up horror scenes ever on like AMC or whatever. Some people were talking about Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. I think it's a clip on YouTube. I forget who it was, but someone was like, you know, that scene's disturbing. But the scariest scene to me is the moment after that when the tape kind of ends and the camera kind of rotates and it shows Henry and Otis on a couch watching their acts of crime and violence and rape and murder.
The moment where the video they're watching is slowed down and it has this really jarring stop motion quality that goes with the beats of the music, I felt physically ill.
Yeah, it's incredibly upsetting. And I think Henry, it does this, sorry, I'm saying Henry as in the character and also Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, the movie as a whole. It does this really interesting thing where I think when we talk about crime and violence in general in society, there's like, does the media we watch cause the violence in our streets?
Mm.
Or, you know, is the media reflecting the violence in our society? And I think what is so interesting about Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is it almost takes it like a serpent eating itself.
Mm.
For these two characters, Otis and Henry, it is a constant circle of eating itself. It is turning into itself. They watch and they do what they want, and then they relive it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they constantly spread it, and it goes further. And the red herring of like, oh no, the video camera, you know, falls out of Otis's hand and they throw it.
Or Becky almost saw it. I thought for sure it would be their downfall. That was such a red herring again and again and again. But it's interesting hearing you talk like this because I really got the sense that the voyeurism and the fetishization of the video camera was mostly Otis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should talk about Otis because Otis was a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
He was a drug dealer. There's definitely a strong implication that he was a closeted homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And he is kind of introduced to murder through Henry and he relishes in it and he gets a bit sloppy.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas Henry is very, you know, cool and calculated, and he's like, here's how you have to do it, Otis. You can't just go off half-cocked like that. So there's kind of this master-student relationship with them, and then when Otis gets going, he can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he goes haywire when it comes to watching the videos. That's when he takes it way too far with Becky. Like, the boundaries seem to blur, and it appears that Henry had that effect on Otis, which I thought was really interesting because, yeah, it was mostly Otis who wanted to watch it and relive it because for him it was such a novelty. For Henry, it was just another day.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why Henry as a figure is so terrifying because he knows how to circumvent it. It was really in the 70s, I believe, that, you know, behavioralism kind of came into criminal profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to get into a lot of that stuff that, of course, became very popular with something like Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
But Henry very casually says, you know, you have to change up the way you murder every time. And then you got to make sure you skip town before they're even on to you, which kind of plays into a little bit of the bureaucracy that we'll get into in the next film. He knows the system. He knows the system, and he knows how to play the system. And the other truly chilling thing I find about this film is that there is mention of the system and how to cheat it, but there is no representation of the system. There is no cop. There is no detective. There is no one who's like, these killings all seem a little similar.
There is one parole officer who's just like, I got a busy day, man. Can we wrap this up?
Like, there is no quote-unquote adult. There was no one who comes in to be like, something's wrong. And even if they don't catch him in the end, that was like, you know, shaking their fist at him as he crosses a state line.
Which is so rare. Most serial killer narratives have some element of cat and mouse. Like, we want to know that someone's on his tail. We want to know that somebody is at least concerned or noticing, maybe like overhearing news clips. Or maybe there are news clips. I don't even think so. I mean, this is Chicago, man. Day in the life of the city, not just Henry.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for the notion of if we consider this film as a portrait and being totally wrapped up in Henry's perception of the events,
that doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist because he's figured out a way to get around it. Mm-hmm. So why would there be a cop? Mm-hmm. But for us as an audience, it's actually quite disturbing and quite upsetting. A writer who I brought up in our Peeping Tom episode, I believe, Susan Sontag, her big piece on photography, she talks about how photos sublimate a person. They take away an essence. They control an essence, things like that. She's written, obviously, quite a bit more about photography. And in her piece regarding the pain of others, she talks quite a bit about, you know, photojournalism and things like that that have to do with distinct suffering, whether it's a war zone or something like that, an image that captures human suffering. And her issue with suffering in photography is that the suffering becomes universal and it immobilizes the viewer. So in seeing someone suffer, you go, oh, that's suffering, you know, in Vietnam, like I could see in a hospital down the street. There's no kind of motion to be like, this suffering is so specific and it is caused by all of these things. And I need to take action to see what I can do to stop this from happening.
Right.
In the universality of it, it kind of washes us, the responder, the viewer, the audience, from having to take action, immobilizing us. Her point is that it would actually require larger texts or narratives to mobilize viewers. So in a way, I think it's interesting that this film opens with these still images or slow images of these dead bodies, all set up in different ways, different genders, places, public, private, as Andrew was mentioning, and in kind of pulling back even further and getting to spend a little bit of time in Henry's head. It can add more context. It can add more fear. It can add more something so that it causes us to think about the kind of crimes that happen. You know, I know for me watching it, I was really, really disturbed by the scene with the two sex workers and how it was just like he just dumps them on the side of the road. And I know, obviously, in Canada, we've just gone through this whole missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls report, which has come out. And the report conducted by our government has come out that all of the missing and murdered Indigenous women is a genocide. So, of course, a lot of white people
were
like,
that word now,
it's like not a genocide. And it is a genocide. It's a 100%. Fucking genocide. And it just made me so angry and upset. And it just threw me into this place. And it was like, the next day I was like getting my MP's email and I was writing her emails. And I was like, it did actually have that effect on me. So I kind of see what Sontag is getting at in this, because the trivialization of human life in this film is so disturbing. It is so disturbing and it's so scary.
It is, and you feel greasy for watching it, but I don't know, it doesn't sensationalize it to the point where, I mean, I mentioned Dexter before, Henry's not a hero, and whatever affection you might have gained for him through Becky throughout the film goes out the window when he kills her.
Oh, yeah. There's a really good article specifically about Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, by a guy named Stefan Handke, called Violence Incorporated. We'll link it in the show notes. He talks a lot about the whole film, but I thought his kind of point towards the end about Henry's dumping of bodies is similar to, you know, the 80s audience and even probably contemporary audiences' reaction to the deaths of victims in slasher films. But by stripping away, as we talked about, the narrative and mythology, that makes the deaths in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer feel more real and harder to digest. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, we're watching Jason tear up a bunch of horny kids at Camp Crystal Lake. A lot of the time, and a lot of screenings I've had, have cheered him on. Mm-hmm. But when you actually think, like, that person wanted to make love and had a family or had dreams.
You don't think of the coroner scraping them off a tree and into a bag and sending that body off to their parents. Like, I don't know, there's something about body disposal that's really, it's an ugly side that we don't always get to see.
Yeah, and I think it is by stripping away those narrative elements and presenting it with this coldness, with this verisimilitude that is so eerie. It just creates this really chilling sensation. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's a pretty unparalleled film. You know, it's not a film I want to revisit.
No.
You know, eventually.
Maybe
I'm
another
sure
10 years. Yeah. It was 10 years. Like, was this your first viewing of it?
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I had seen it, you know, it was kind of like one of the essential horror movies you need to see. And I watched it and I was like, that's icky. And I didn't think too much of it the way I did this time.
Yeah, I think it's a really great film, but it's very effective. That's why it's a great film. And in being effective, it's like, I'm going to carry the sentiments that I think this film was trying to impart to me for a while.
Yes.
So I don't need to revisit it.
That's right. And I think it is singular in the horror genre in that it is such a stark depiction from the killer's point of view. There's no cat and mouse. There's no police chasing that we're aware of. It's a portrait of a serial killer from the 80s. It's a portrait of the 80s through the narrative of serial killer.
Yeah. There is no gloss. There is no greed is good. There is no Patrick Bateman. There is just Henry.
So moving along from a snapshot of a serial killer in the 80s, we're going to skip ahead to 2007 with Zodiac by director David Fincher, based on Robert Graysmith's 1986 book.
Dear editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl on the 4th of July.
I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper.
He wants his code in the afternoon edition.
Ray Smith, don't you have my cartoon to finish?
The Zodiac Killer has come to San Francisco.
Another letter.
School children make nice targets.
He gave himself a name.
Greek. Morse code, astrological signs. This guy's used them all.
I like killing people because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
How does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them a lot.
Got any hard suspects?
About 90 an hour. I'm up to around 500.
You got 4 crime scenes. Not a single usable print. You can't think of this case in normal police terms.
He's breaking the pattern.
Lena said you were a cartoonist.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing at a gun range?
I just want to help.
What are you, some kind of Boy Scout?
Eagle Scout, actually. First class.
Well, I've been thinking.
Oh, God, save us all.
There's no evidence, Robert.
What do you mean there's no evidence? You have him seen with the ciphers, the military boot prints, the bloody knife.
All circumstantial.
Why do you need to do this?
Because nobody else will.
Dave, you made a mistake!
Get away from the window.
Paul, are you okay?
No.
Why'd you do it? You put your face out there for him to see.
Hello? Who is this?
Zodiac was my job. It's not yours.
He's still out there, Dave.
Killing is his compulsion. It drives him. It's in his blood.
Jeez.
What?
Squirrels.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
I have a gun.
I can give you a lift to the service station.
Do you always go around helping people in the night?
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Are you sure there's nobody else in the house?
Now, the movie is based on the real-life case of the Zodiac Killer who operated in California from the late 60s to the early 70s. This was a serial killer who not only switched up his MO from attack to attack, but he liked to taunt the population by sending letters with encrypted messages to the press, threatening to kill more innocent people unless his letters made the front page. It was a long, drawn-out investigation with many moving parts, including the San Francisco police, the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper, and the higher echelons of the California Department of Justice. And they're all represented in this film with the nuts and bolts intact. Now, Fincher's movie follows this story by focusing on a few main players. The Chronicle's alcoholic crime reporter, Paul Avery, the Chronicle's super keen cartoonist, Robert Graysmith, and San Francisco homicide detectives Toshi and Armstrong. Now, we see dramatizations of the murders and the first Zodiac letters arriving at the press, with Avery and Graysmith working together to crack the code. We see the initial investigation by the police that slowly points to a suspect, Arthur Lee Allen, but they're unable to make an arrest due to lack of evidence. Eventually, over the course of the movie, we not only see the case go cold, but we see it take a terrible toll on the people involved, primarily Avery, who retires from journalism into drugs and alcohol, Toshi, who is accused of professional misconduct, and Graysmith, who loses his job, wife, and kids due to his obsession with keeping this case alive. It's a long film, and I have to say, when I sat down to watch it, I had never seen it before prior to preparing for this episode. I was like, 2 hours and 20 minutes? The fuck is this? Some Ari Aster shit. But unlike Ari Aster, and very much like David Fincher, this is a very economical 2.5 hours because this story is huge. And there are spots where he could have trimmed the fat that would have cost the film narratively and maybe robbed it of its emotional heft.
And you would have lost, like, the personality.
Totally.
If you didn't have a few, like, I find there's just a great tonal balance to this film. This is a film I've really loved since I first saw it, which was shortly after its release, that I've kind of gone back to every couple years. And then when I started dating my now husband, his internet was really shitty, so I just leave, like, USB sticks of movies that we could watch together. Mm-hmm. And it had come up that he had never seen Zodiac, but he liked Fincher and he loves movies in general. So I was like, oh, shit, we gotta watch Zodiac. I think you'll really, really like it. And then he came home late from a shift, so I wasn't there. This is when we weren't living together yet. And he watched it, and he stayed up and watched the whole thing. And, like, the next day, he was, like, a Zodiac head. To the point where, like, he watched it, I don't know, 10 times in a few weeks.
Oh, my God.
It played at our wedding in the background on mute because we just loved it so much. We wanted it to be part of our special day. We watched it over the Christmas break, and I was watching it, of course, to prepare for this episode, and he came home halfway through, and he was just kind of quietly, like, quoting the film as it went along. So I've got a little Graysmith on my hands. But I think this is an excellent film. I'm not always the biggest Fincher fan. I think Fincher is a great stylized visualizer. But the two films that he's made that I really, really love are among two of my favorite films ever, which is Zodiac and Gone Girl.
Gone Girl.
And I think when he's a bit of a chameleon when it comes to scripts. Obviously, he's not a writer, but when he gets a script that I think suits him, kind of suits that, like, icy detachment, it really plays to some of his strengths as a visual storyteller, and I find this is a good balance of those things. The narrative doesn't get away from the visuals. The visuals enhance the story.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a very kind of cohesive world-building film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always feel really immersed in these characters. I really care about these characters. I'm going to talk a little bit about masculinity in this film, and I think it's a very personal film, and, you know, that goes to speak to the books that this is based on by Robert Graysmith, and, you know, Danny being a Zodiac head, for this past Christmas, I got him some of the Graysmith books. I think he read most of them, and I picked them up to read a bit for this episode, if you saw my Instagram story, and they are dense.
Are they really?
Dense. They're dense in terms of, like, a breakdown of information. It goes, like, beat to beat to beat to beat. You can tell, like,
he's not a writer.
He's not a writer, but he's not a bad writer.
Okay.
But he's putting, like, some texture in there. He's trying to put some flourish in there.
Okay.
He's trying to, like, shape it a bit, but it really is dense with information.
Mm.
I was skipping around a bit just to try to find some of the points of the film that I found really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're there. But it was a passion project for the screenwriter James Vanderbilt. And he went into a spec script option with Phoenix Films. And their first choice for the director for Zodiac was always Fincher. You know, obviously he had a lot of success with a film like Seven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's also done, like, procedural serial killer films with something like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I mean, the best thing about that film was probably the Karen O cover of Immigrant Song. But
pretty good.
Yeah, it's a great cover. the movie's okay. But Fincher also grew up in that area of California during that time period. So he had a really personal connection to the Zodiac story. So he was really on board to do this film. And it sounds like there was a lot of respect towards Vanderbilt's script, but that Fincher worked on the script with him a bit. I would definitely say it's not like a Fincher undercutting anyone. It was just like the two very passionate people who really were invested in telling this story. So
I don't think he's that kind of filmmaker. Like, even when it came to Seven, there was, you know, a very iconic ending that he had to fight for, an ending that made the film, another serial killer police procedural. And he was also the guy behind the Netflix series Mindhunter. Did you watch that?
I tried and I couldn't get into it.
Oh, fuck, man. I ate that up. I loved it. It was like the sociology of criminology, but fictionalized and displayed with a major babe in the lead.
You want to talk about major babes? I'm getting Mark Ruffalo and Anthony Edwards in scenes together.
You know, of the major babes in this movie, I think Jake slays them all. But that's okay. We can still be friends.
Different strokes for different folks. If we like the same guys, maybe we wouldn't be as good friends as we are.
True that. True that. So, once more, this film is very long, but I feel like it has really important beats. I have only seen it once, obviously, but I'm desperate to see it again because I feel like there's stuff that I missed. I appreciate that he took some care to depict the murders the way he did, and particularly the murder of the couple by the water.
Is that because one of them was a sociologist?
That was a hilarious bonus. I just found it so... I don't know. There was something about the way it was shot. This is not a horror film, but that scene got me in the feels.
I agree. This is not a horror film. We're throwing a little horror adjacent number in here, and that's because I loved it, and I did really want Andrea to see it after her misadventure with some other Zodiac-like film, which she watched by mistake.
God damn it. I hope that didn't happen to any of you.
Yeah. So yes, this is a horror adjacent film. But I think there are moments and scenes and beats that play out just like a horror film. There's one particular that I think we'll talk about in a little bit. But let's talk about the one in the park by the lake. That scene to me reeks of a misuse, a mistrust, I don't know what you'd want to call it, of the social contracts that we all rely on a daily basis. You know, I'm just going to do me and I will leave everyone else alone and hope no one hurts me if I don't hurt them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this scene continues to violate it at every step. It's so horrifying. And it's horrifying in the way, like, it's just this kind of slow setup. You know, he approaches them, demands their wallet, holds them at gunpoint, ties them up, and then the guy, you know, asks.
You know, just because people are going to ask, was that thing even loaded?
The killer reveals that the gun was loaded, and then he puts the gun away to stab them. Stab them in the back while this couple is looking at each other. It's horrifying.
It is horrifying.
And, you know, it's the same kind of thing with the first kill in the film, which is just eerie. And in both cases, the women die and the men survive. And that feels truly unsettling.
Yes. Yeah, and these were, like, very relatable people minding their own business, you know what I mean? I didn't feel like they were... This isn't the slasher narrative where there are two kids getting up to no good. They were flirting. It was fine. And the couple by the lake, man.
So one of the things I really like about this film, and what always kind of comes to the forefront for me, is that while the film includes murders and scenes of terror and fearish scenes, this film is ultimately... not about the victims of the violence. It is about the people following the case. So again, we're focusing on Paul Avery, we're focusing on Robert Graysmith, and how those lives begin to unravel the more they become involved with the Zodiac.
The more they follow it. I consider them victims.
Yeah, victims in a way that maybe a normal narrative wouldn't. It depicts this kind of unraveling of the self in the face of something bigger. And the Zodiac wasn't this prolific killer. You know, he killed several people, but not a lot, and it consumes them. Now, one of the things I think Zodiac sets up in a really interesting way, and I think Fincher handles this really well, is the sense of converging fate that happens throughout the film. There's, I'm sure, so many people were touched by the Zodiac. So many people were involved. So many people were investigating. So many people were victims or close to the victims. But what this film does, and it's portrayed, I think, really well in the opening, you know, scenes over the credits, where you've got Jake Gyllenhaal dropping his son off to school, and you've got the letter arriving at the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's like these things are all kind of coming together. They're making stops. They're stopping by their desks. The letter is getting passed from someone to someone to someone, and all of a sudden, you get this convergence of fate, where mm-hmm. he's arrived in the editorial room. He's probably the lowest on, you know, the rung there, and immediately the secretary comes in and says, "You need to see this." Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the plot begins.
Yeah.
The plot begins. The chase begins. The plot thickens. However you want to term it, it's all there. And the same thing happens, I'd say, about kind of halfway through the first third of the film, as we're introduced to Tachi. And this is really where the cab driver murder happens. And from what I've read, there wasn't a lot of time spent on the cab driver murder because the cab driver did not survive. Mm-hmm. So they didn't actually have a ton of information. So they decided to approach it from the people who did have the information, who are the people who arrived on the scene, detectives, right. police officers. So it makes actually quite a bit of sense. They dramatize this film. They dramatize relationships. But it seems like in terms of the crimes, they tried to stick as close as they could to it.
But he throws in those little Easter eggs. Like, it's something as stupid as the animal crackers.
It yeah.
just adds so much personality.
Mark Ruffalo can have my animal crackers.
Oh, dear me.
And another thing I love about this film, and maybe this is because I kind of work for the government, is the bureaucracy in this film.
I love it. It's what I loved about Chernobyl.
It's
what I loved, how it, like, it's so broken.
It is like, I'll fax it to you. We don't have a fax. Did you know about this? No, I didn't. Who has that? Well, they have it over there.
Yeah.
And so basically, you know, it's portrayed in the film that you've got three different counties mm-hmm. with three different murders over mm-hmm. lines, over county lines, trying to coordinate efforts, and they can't communicate with each other. And it's like, sometimes they don't really want to communicate because there is that, you know, like, if we're going to crack this, we will crack it. They won't.
That's right.
But also then there's the, like, well, I don't have fucking time to do this.
There's, this is classified, and I don't know if you have that. Like, there's a little bit of cock swinging, too.
Oh, absolutely. But I love that this film can portray the kind of, quote-unquote, boring minutiae of solving the case and make it filmic and make it interesting and funny and satirical.
It's so important. Like, mm-hmm. just how, like, we're talking about how true crime nouveau, modern true crime, points to these inefficiencies within the system. Mm-hmm. The Zodiac does that too. And I mean, we're looking from a bird's eye view. This is 2007 when the movie is made, and we're looking back in time. And so we're looking at a pre-internet era, and we can tell ourselves till we're blue in the face that things are better now. They're probably not.
Not really. We just have more ways to be accessed. But because we have more ways to be accessed, it doesn't mean we can always respond in time.
That's right.
So I think the lack of communication, I think the complications of communication, they still speak as really strong thematic elements and speak as important things that we grapple with today. And I like that the film takes pains to show that, because this was a huge barrier to solving the case, on top of many other barriers to solving this case.
That's right. And I used to love Law and Order.
Oh, God, I love Law and Order.
I love Law and Order. And my favorite episodes were the ones where, you know, we know he's guilty. We just can't get him because of the way the system is built. And the system is built to protect us and blah, blah, blah. But there's no fluidity. The system is so rigid and it's so old. And I think what I love about this film most is reflected in its tagline, which is, there's more than one way to lose your life to a killer. And for me, that's what elevates this film above and beyond true crime, above and beyond, like, a normal slasher. I think that's fundamentally what this film is about. It's a fascinating case of a serial killer, yes, but what's more is the ripple effect
mm-hmm.
that claimed the lives throughout all these different spheres of society. There was journalism, there was law enforcement, there was law right down to the micro, where people's families were concerned that you are a very conspicuous figure in this case, and I feel like our children are at risk. I think that's totally normal and totally valid, and I like how that factored into this.
The film does a really great job of elevating normalcy and relatability,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the face of something as terrifying as a serial killer, like when the Zodiac seems to kind of reach out to especially Avery and Graysmith, that those things are, I'm actually getting a chill thinking about it right now. It's just fascinating. I love it.
The characters are so well drawn. And I was commenting to Alex before we started recording that I especially appreciated the fact that Graysmith's, I don't know, second wife We kind of witness snippets of their romance from the very beginning, but she's never portrayed as an unreasonable harpy, which is something that so many filmmakers would have just been like, ah, he lost his nag of a wife who didn't understand his passion for this case. You know, and it doesn't even portray Grace Smith as a monster for being obsessed with this case either. It's just something that happens. It's a phenomenon that captivated a city.
Well, yeah, and you've got, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal playing Robert Graysmith with, like, the biggest eyes. You know, as he says, he is an Eagle Scout first class. He has this puppyish quality, and he wants to solve it, and you as an audience member want him to solve it because you want resolution. Mm-hmm. Even when his kids get involved, and you see Chloe Sevigny, he plays his second wife, you know, she comes to him at the end, and it seems to be pretty clear that their marriage is pretty much over, mm-hmm. but she tells him to finish it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's pretty huge. And even Tachi, who's played by Mark Ruffalo, you know, he tells Graysmith to finish it.
Yeah.
Finish his book. Do something with it.
Or it's going to consume you.
Yeah. I can't think of another film that really does this in a really successful or interesting way. And for me, one of the biggest themes of this film is the passage of time. And I think that's why it leads to this long runtime, because information pops up, things happen, and, you know, they happen in short order, but then there's a period where it'll go quiet, and so you have to pick up the story again.
It's tricky to do.
It's hard.
A lot of shows fuck that up. You're mm-hmm. just kind of like, how long has passed since the last scene? But this, it was very clear. I specifically remember one montage where it was just like, there was images, but there was also audio snippets of news mm-hmm. and like the Manson murders had happened. This was playing on the radio musically. It set the stage so beautifully in a montage that was maybe 10 seconds.
Yeah. Buildings are getting built in montages. Mm-hmm. If you notice, if you watch the film, if you have noticed already, if you watch it again, you'll notice the office space of the Chronicle change. Paint colors change, lighting changes. It's evolving. It's moving.
It's probably shrinking.
Yeah. But this notion of a consumption of time, I think, is really fascinating. And I think it's oftentimes what we have in film is a shortening of time. We have creating a succinct narrative. I'm going to dive into talking a little bit more about narrative structure here. But I thought it was super interesting that they included Detective Tachi, again, played by Mark Ruffalo. Just to say Mark Ruffalo.
Call her.
He was obviously a real person. He was quite a famous detective. Most notably, he was the inspiration for the character Dirty Harry. Steve McQueen based his performance on him, on Tachi in the film Bullet. So when, you know, they go to the cinema in Zodiac and they're watching that film, that's Dirty Harry. And Tachi is like the Clint Eastwood character in it.
But he can't deal...
You've got this, you know, quiet, smart, gentle, soft-spoken bit of a wild dresser who loves animal crackers in front of you for, like, 2.5 hours trying to sort through this mystery with these other weirdos. And then he's got this screen version of him that's, like, Clint Eastwood at his peak being like, fuck everything.
Yeah.
I'm Dirty Harry.
Badass, yeah.
And so if that's one side of the coin, you know, the laconic nature of this script, the fact that it is taking its time, that it spans from, you know, the late 60s to the early 90s, there needs to be a breadth of time to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to so much of what true crime is it's often a revisiting of a case with new information, with new technology. And for me, it's often the true crime I become interested in and I get involved in. It's, you know, a revisiting of a case. It's a reexamination. And there's a new factor. There's a new taker. There's a new something. But there is still no conclusion at the end.
Yeah.
It's open-ended. There are mm-hmm. theories. You can direct people towards a theory, but it's not conclusive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you should say, because I wasn't going to bring it up. We took so much pains at the beginning of this episode to be like, this isn't a true crime podcast. We're not going to talk about true crime. We're going to talk about these movies, but we're not going to talk about true crime. I saw that there is new evidence submitted for DNA within this case in 2018.
Right. Yes, I did see that.
I mean, the fact that true crime is always ever unfolding means there might yet be another Zodiac movie in the future.
Well, and I think it's interesting because you've got this narrative, and they're obviously playing into, you know, Robert Graysmith and, you know, his research and what he believes, which is that Arthur Lee Allen was the Zodiac. there was never enough to convict him. There was some stuff that really lines up, but it didn't line up enough.
Oh, he slipped between their fingers, you know? Yeah.
But the thing is, a lot of people are like, it was never Arthur Lee Allen for all of these reasons. You can read up on them on your own. I won't go into them here, but, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, no, Graysmith fudged some stuff. You know, his birthday wasn't actually in December. And in Zodiac, the film, we have the really amazing character actor, John Carroll Lynch, who, I mean, as soon as I saw him on screen, I was like, shit, I've seen that guy everywhere. Uh-huh. And he's terrific in this film. So apparently, Fincher had different actors play the Zodiac Killer in each of the killing scenes. Oh. So it's not like John Carroll Lynch playing him, or it's not one stunt guy. It's a myriad of people.
Okay.
So that there was never a kind of conclusive answer to
right.
it.
It's and amorphous.
That, yeah, it's amorphous. And then, you know, Fincher apparently told Lynch that he should play the part as innocent.
As if he's innocent.
Yes. Just because the film, the narrative and the script and everything points so directly to Arthur Lee Allen being the killer, he wanted to obviously have some kind of tension and something to keep people intrigued. So if you had him, like, twirling a mustache and going, like, I killed those crazy kids up at the lake, that's not fun. That's right. not interesting. It doesn't pull you in like it pulls those men in
right.
that destroys them. So I think you need to have that balance. And I'm glad they did it that way.
Yeah, totally.
So if Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is about the reception of violence and the internalization of violence, then for me, Zodiac is about the production of violence and how it reaches the mainstream and the public spheres. From hard evidence to impossible leads, how violence and murder becomes part of the public consciousness is a really important element of this film. You know, it's from the outset. It's, you know, the Zodiac did these killings and then he announces himself to the public.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the police break something, because again, we've got that bureaucracy play where he's, you know, killed people across different lines, so no one's really talking to each other. They haven't even really linked them, but he links himself. He demands that these codes go in newspapers and that it go out into the world. Otherwise, he's going to pick off those kids from the...
It's assault. Terrorism, more or less.
Absolutely.
He held that city at ransom.
And to me, that says that the media is at the forefront of the killer's mind, that terror and panic can spread much more easily when it hits screens or newspapers of note.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this isn't like a sleazy tabloid. This is, you know, a paper of record. He's reaching out to Melvin Belli, a really famous defense attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And he defended some really crazy fucks, but he was also involved in Hollywood. So it would make sense that someone pretending to be the Zodiac would want to speak to him. And that he would also appear on television to go do it, because mm-hmm. it seems like he was a bit of a publicity hound. And again, played in a very tongue-in-cheek way by Brian Cox.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, again, this film finds, like, real moments of levity and interest to kind of break it up. So it's not this dense procedural. It's a dense procedural with interesting characters who you like and you mm-hmm. care about. For me, the film also resists a narrative structure, even though the events within the film are fictionalized. You can deep dive into all of the quote-unquote factual inaccuracies. Like, Graysmith and Avery weren't friends. They didn't really know each other. But they know each other in this film. And it's great, because it kind of works, and it highlights some really interesting elements of this plot. But
it helps you care.
Yeah, it helps you care. And I'm saying that this film resists a narrative structure, much in the same way that Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer does, is because there is no resolution. There are elements that kind of come into play, but really it's more of like a cyclical nature of characters. The characters all go through something, mm-hmm. and then their kind of arc ends, you know. Bill Armstrong gets out of homicide. Tosh is, you know, kind of thrown out of homicide. Avery...
I moved onto a boat.
Moves onto a houseboat.
I feel like there's the houseboat, and then there's... Didn't he die? Didn't the epilogue, like...
Yeah, and he dies.
The respirator. Anyway.
Ultimately, for Graysmith, who emerges as, I think, the true protagonist of this film, he's mm-hmm. the one who we follow the most consistently throughout the film, mm-hmm. who the film always returns to, who is the most dogged in his pursuit and his earnestness and willing to follow this case to the very end.
It was never his job.
It was never his job.
It was always a passion project, and that's why he couldn't leave it alone.
No. And he accomplishes something in the publishing of the book, which you get to see at the very end. But... even that is just a recap of the events that we have seen. It is a telling of the versions of events that we've already seen in the hopes of him putting it all together, of him kind of maybe, you know, directing people towards one person in particular. It might illuminate something. It might reveal something. And the killer can be brought to justice or something will happen so that there will be closure to this. But ultimately, there is no closure to this. I think the notion of games and crypts and codes is really interesting. Again, I love the scene where it's, you know, they get the CIA, they get the FBI on it very early on in the film, and it's a husband and wife couple who crack it over the breakfast table.
Yeah.
You know, I think there is an involvement in the public consciousness so early on. And I think that's why, you know, the Zodiac Killer has resonated across so many places in our public consciousness. Like when you talk to or you see interviews, the police officers and detectives who worked on it, they're clearly not over it. They're still thinking about it. They still grapple with it. The way the public was brought into it made it part of the public consciousness, made it part of the public's responsibility to deal with this. You know, so it extends beyond the victims. It extends beyond something like the Manson murders or things like that, which even though it was a public trial, it was dealing with a very specific sphere of people in a very specific area of Hollywood. The Zodiac has this kind of strange democratic entry to the case. You know, it wasn't...
It has a populism.
Exactly.
It's almost soothing to see someone like Grace Smith, who's like, again, like I said, it's not your job. And it's not any of our jobs, but we can become consumed with these cases. We can become passionate about them. We can pick up the pieces and want to sort them out from ourselves, just like the way he did. And I think it's actually really emblematic of the full circle that true crime has become, where you don't have to be a weirdo. You don't have to be sadistic. You don't have to be reveling in people's pain to want to sort these things out and to be interested and captivated by these cases.
One of the final things I want to say about this film is I want to talk about one of the reasons I almost thought you wouldn't like it.
Ooh.
I wasn't sure. I was like, Andrea might really, really like it. Or she might be like, nope, this is not for me. Partially, to be quite honest, it was because it's such a male-dominated narrative. But I was like, Andrea likes films with men in it. But it's such a male-dominated narrative. And then, I know you mentioned you watched it and you liked it and you were into it. So I was like, okay, that's a big load off my mind, because it would have sucked to have gotten you to watch like a 2+ hour film and you not liked it.
Ah, whatever.
And so it got me thinking about the kind of men in this film.
Okay.
And I wouldn't go as far as to say, like, kind of like we did in Ravenous, that despite, you know, its general lack of women in this film, it's, you know, feminist film because of the way the men are like this, that, or the other. I wouldn't say that about this film. What I will say is I really appreciate its portrayal of men. I like the way it treats its male characters and actually treats them as quite individual, quite sensitive, funny, caring, charismatic, shy, awkward. It does all of these things.
Flawed.
And just interesting people. Again, to go back to that kind of Tachi and Eastwood comparison, you've got the quiet, mumbly, soft-spoken guy versus the personification of him on a Hollywood screen.
It would have been so easy to paint him as this gunslinger, as this badass loudmouth who just doesn't give a fuck and kicks ass and takes names.
But that's been done.
And it's conspicuous that they didn't go that route.
I just love that we've got some different portrayals of men on screen. And I think that's why I so immediately kind of became invested in this film, because the men in this film feel like men I know in real life. And I think that's really appealing. And I imagine if you're a fan of this film, that's partially what appeals to you, because they feel so human and they feel so normal. And I really enjoy that.
We're talking about a point in history where these key players were necessarily male because these positions were occupied exclusively by men. I think it makes sense that they're all men in this film, but I see where you're coming from. I think Fincher presented them as flawed and complicated and this and that. Gray Smith is definitely the hero, but he's certainly not portrayed as this gunslinger. He's this super keen dork.
He's a fucking Eagle Scout. He's the Eagle Scout who smoked once in high school.
Adorable. He's a dork, but he's definitely not like a leading man. He's the affable sidekick, and yet he's the one who carries this narrative along, and indeed he's the one who shows an awful lot of balls when he's put in a very compromising situation later on.
And before we get into that compromising situation, because I do want to talk about that, I do want to mention, I think it's so interesting. I mean, not interesting, but I'm so happy that Robert Downey Jr. is in this film, because this is kind of one of the films that came out right before he transitioned into Iron Man and like Mr. Marvel.
Right.
And as he was, you know, kind of coming out of his going from like Hollywood bad boy to former Hollywood actor in jail and reviled by the community, to recovering drug addict, to taking on character parts and bit parts and building up that reputation again to be like, I can work and I can do this. Hire me. And so I think there's actually a very interesting self-reflexive take on this. As someone who's seen several of the Marvel movies, you can kind of see how he's parlayed that persona into Iron Man.
Yes.
I don't think he'll be playing Iron Man anytime soon again, but I hope this, you know, he'll return to doing films like this because I think he's a great actor and it's nice seeing him work on screen.
Yeah.
Like actually show up and act.
I think he took this role, I think it's a little bit autobiographical, whereas, you know, yes, I turned to these vices. I turned to drugs and alcohol, but there are reasons. There are superfluous reasons, and they don't make me a monster.
No. But let's talk about the scene. The scene that I would say is like a mini horror film.
That's a scene out of a horror film.
That's a fucking scene out of the horror film, and it's a scene. It's not the climax of the film. It's not the end of the film. It's kind of like an emotional climax of the film.
Yeah, it comes at the right moment when you need it, to be honest.
So, Gray Smith has gotten this random tip about this guy named Rick Marshall. Rick Marshall is the killer. He's the Zodiac. And he was a projectionist. And, like, look at the posters. Look at this. Look at that. So, he starts to investigate this. And he, you know, gets contact. And he's going to go to this guy's house to learn more about it. And as soon as he gets into this house...
Oh, you have a basement. Oh, you're left-handed. And all this, and like, there's no wife saying I told you so, but there's a wife saying watch out. You know, it's delicious.
Yeah, and it is such a beautifully executed mini horror movie.
So suspenseful. You're genuinely worried about him. You're genuinely wondering what the fuck it is you would do. And I found myself in that position at several points during this film. When people were getting murdered. Here, take my wallet. Here, I'm babbling. Oh Jesus Christ! And now I'm getting stabbed.
But I think what's so interesting about this basement scene is it's, to me, as we're saying, like, this is the most kind of quote-unquote horror-like element or horror-like scene in this film, but it's a red herring.
Mm-hmm.
This guy seems not to be the Zodiac killer. Is there someone upstairs? Is that the Zodiac killer? I don't think so. But what the fuck else are they up to?
It's not really the point,
is
it?
It's not.
It's just kind of, it's the moment where he realizes that the peril is real. And that all the distance that I was talking about before, the true crime distance of playing armchair detective, that distance can shrink.
So here's my question to you.
Uh-oh.
Is it his realization of peril or is it his paranoia?
Oh, interesting. Well, I guess I'd have to watch it again to really
I don't think there's
that.
A right answer. But that's I'm literally between those two.
I took it as, oh shit, I've finally come too close. After all these years, after all this work, after all the allies I've made and, like, alliances I've broken, I have put myself in a position where I could be fucked. You thought it might be all in his head?
Maybe not all in his head, but just an interpretation of the events that are happening in front of him. It skewed his perception.
That's interesting.
But again, I don't fully believe that. Mm-hmm. It's just something that kind of occurs to me every time I watch it. Like, if you go down that rabbit hole far enough, does everything become fearful and terrifying? Probably.
Shit. I mean, I don't know.
But that's our talk about Zodiac. In as much as we can kind of bring it to this conclusion, I think it's a film that has a lot of different elements to it. I think it's a film that has a lot of different things going on in it, and it pays attention to each of them and pulls it off. And it's a film that I've returned to multiple times, and each time I enjoy it. You know, I think the ultimate kind of takeaway about this killer is, you know, when Tachi's kind of first introduced to the narrative and he's interviewing the kids after the cab driver is shot, and the kids say he looked, quote unquote, normal. There is the normalcy to this. It parallels into a bit of Henry. It's like all of these things, this world that we live in can be so easily disrupted. And I think Zodiac shows us the different ways it can disrupt our lives.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm really glad this film exists. And I think as an inverse of Henry in many ways, going from situating itself in the killer's head to situating itself into solely the people who are trying to track him down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really fascinating. And I think it's a hard thing to do. And I think this film pulls it off in a way that is pretty complicated to do.
There are two sides to the coin. I think they're perfectly complementing sides. I think they were really good selections for this particular episode. And again, I think this was an episode that we wanted to tackle this subject, but we didn't want to talk about true crime the way everybody talks about true crime. We wanted a faculty of horror true crime, which is to say we took a horror movie, very much a horror movie that was bleak and nihilistic and scary and grimy as Portrait of a Serial Killer. And then we talked about Zodiac, which, you know, kind of takes a really macro sociological cultural approach to what impact across history serial killers have on the cultural psyche. Like, it makes a mark. It leaves a mark.
And it's a traumatic incident.
That's right. And I think it's completely normal and totally understandable for people to be fascinated by that and drawn in by that. And insofar as I'm thrilled that true crime is having a heyday where there's a sense of shamelessness, where people are spending money on it, I'd like to see that happen with horror. I think it's sort of happening with horror, with the elevated horror, but whereas I see elevated horror drawing a line within the genre, true crime seems to be on a trajectory.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd like to see that kind of shamelessness. I think it's one thing to say, yes, I'm into true crime, because to admit that is to admit that you are critically minded, that you are incisive, that you're not afraid to look into the darkness of humanity. And I think all of these things apply to a horror fan, but people aren't really quite as willing to adopt that mantle in that same way.
You know, and I will actually agree with a lot of that. I think one thing for me that kind of switched up my take on true crime and kind of made me want to think about this episode and want to really do it, because we have talked about it for a while, is I read the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark about the Golden State Killer, which was written by Michelle McNamara. And she passed away before the book was completed, basically due to a mix of prescription drugs in her system. And the general consensus is that the trauma and the researching of this case kind of consumed her and led to her to have trouble sleeping. And it's incredibly sad. She was married to Patton Oswalt. They were married at the time and they had a daughter together. And she passed away and they finished the book for her on her behalf. It was about half done, I think, maybe a bit less than half. You know, the first couple chapters of the book are very much written by her and kind of finished and polished by her, and they're so strong. And then the book kind of goes on, and it sums up all her research and what she's done. It brought in a couple other people she was working with to kind of polish it and finish it. But nothing is as strong as those first chapters. And you realize the kind of toll, I think, that chasing these things down takes on a person.
Well, trying to make sense of things that don't make sense, right?
Yeah.
And something as fundamental
and what's ultimately crazy is that that book led to an arrest in
did
that
it really?
Case. It did. Like, in the last year.
That's interesting to bring up because this true crime, this new wave of true crime is having impact on the cases themselves.
Yeah.
Like the case investigated by Serial Season 1 led to an appeal that was ultimately rejected. Who knows if that would have happened without that show? Same with Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
Like, this is a real phenomenon with real effect, and it's something that perhaps we're going to need a little bit more distance from before we can really look back and assess fully whether or not this was a good or bad thing for the criminal justice system.
You know, these are their stories.
Dun, dun.
But I think there is a responsibility, I think, that comes along with talking about true crime that doesn't necessarily come with talking about fictional horror films or literature or what have you.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you want to be talking about something in a way that is appropriate and correct and using the right terminology. Obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you know, we work towards that constantly. And in true crime, it's an acknowledgement that these are real people and real families and real cases and people who had to get to the scene first and first responders. And it's a very sobering thing.
It is.
You know, like, I'm sure we all like to get together with friends and like watch Halloween 6 because it's a dumb fucking movie. And Paul Rudd gives the worst performance ever in it. I can't do that with a film that's based on, like, John Wayne Gacy.
Mm.
Even if, like, there is a trashy film about John Wayne Gacy, but I don't want to watch it. You know?
Yeah,
so
it's
complex, guys.
It is. It's complex and it's murky, and I think I would have never butt up against it in such a serious way were it not for the magazine, where it's like, I will put Freddy Krueger on the cover because he is an idea. He is a concept. He is a manifestation of a whole bunch of anxieties. He's not a real monster.
No, you're not putting Ted Bundy on the cover.
Never.
No.
Not going to happen. Anyway, that's enough of that.
That's true crime.
It's wonderful. It's fun. Have fun
yeah.
with it. Just keep it fun.
Yeah, keep it fun and be responsible and take care of yourself, because some of this stuff can be really triggering. And take care of yourself, take care of each other. That's a good motto to have in life.
Yeah, to close out the Jerry Springer show.
Yeah, I mean, Andrea, if you ever move on a houseboat, I will come visit you.
You will?
Yeah.
Bring the blue drinks?
I'll bring the blue drinks, babe. Aw,
thanks.
So...
Actually, that sounds nice for the summer. Let's go. Let's do that on our sabbatical.
Yes.
While these guys do their homework. Should we assign their homework?
Let's.
I think they're going to need 2 months to puzzle over this film. I know I'm going to need 2 months to think it over.
Oh, fuck yeah. Episode. We're doing House or Houseu.
That's going to be our September episode. Now, this one is a completely bonkers Japanese ball to the wall bizarro weirdo horror film. I love it deeply. I think I put it as our Halloween Horror Nights list, on an early list, and I included an image, and I remember choosing an image from this crazy bonkers film. Like, what image am I gonna choose that perfectly conveys? I don't even think I did it. So watch it a third time. And then stay tuned for our September episode where we unpack it to its crazy bits and bobs.
To summarize what we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, Salem Horror Fest, October 5th, we are going to be there. Tickets linked in the show notes. Faculty of Horror merch is available. The class of 2019 stuff is available till the end of August via Twisted Tees. Link will be available in the show notes. And... finally, subscribe to our newsletter. It will give you fun content. It'll also give you news. We've got some promo codes in there. We're working on some other deals and partnerships so that we can bring you guys some cool shit.
Yeah, and it's a really good
save
idea.
You some money if you want to buy shit.
You know, like social media algorithms being what they are, you can follow us. I encourage you to follow us. But if you want to get up-to-date stuff and not miss a thing, the newsletter is the way to do it.
Yeah. We want to talk to you guys. And we want to talk to you guys directly. So this is a good way for us to do it. Okay.
So until next time. Have a fantastic summer. Be safe.
Don't investigate anything we wouldn't investigate.
Which is to say, investigate everything, but from a safe distance.
And until next time,
office hours are closed.
Thrown like a star in my vast deep, I open my eyes to take a peek. To find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love. Histories of ages past, unenlightened shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing songs of love. Hurdy-gurdy-gurdy-gurdy-gurdy-gurdy-gurdy-gurdy sang. Hurdy-gurdy-hurdy-gurdy-hurdy-gurdy-hurdy-gurdy-hurdy-gurdy. Roll it, 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 roll it
hand in hand.